Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Red China was largely closed in the thick of Cultural Revolution, Jan Wong dove right in anyway. A third-generation Canadian of Chinese descent, the self-described Montreal Maoist, read Das Kapital at Beijing University, became a factory hand, transplanted rice in Chinese patties, and betrayed a fellow student. More than 30 years later, Jan Wong decided to find out what had become of her. This hour on Point, we'll hear her story of betrayal, the search for one person, a search for redemption in China. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine being a young foreigner in Mao's China, wanting so badly to fit in that you betray a fellow student who confides that she wants to leave? Would you go back and try to make it right? Joining me now from Toronto is Jan Wong, author of A Comrade Lost and Found, A Beijing Story. In 1972, Wong traveled to China and became the first Canadian admitted to study at Beijing University. She went on to cover business for the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, and the Toronto Globe and Mail. From 1988 to 94, she was the Globe and Mail's Beijing correspondent. She later became a columnist for that newspaper and left in 2006. 25 years ago, she and I were colleagues at the Boston Globe. I don't think we've spoken since. Jan Wong, welcome. It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you again.
My goodness.
It has been 25 years.
It's been a long time, and you've had quite the journey since then. I knew some of your life in China from our time together in the early 1980s, but I didn't know it had quite this much drama in it, Jan. You weren't letting on, or maybe you weren't thinking about it then.
Well, I don't think I remembered all the drama. I know it's hard for people to believe, but I keep moving on in my life. So I do something and then I move on. And I really didn't remember this dramatic incident until 1994 when I was finishing my posting in Beijing for the Globe and Mail. And then I reread my dusty old diaries from my student days and I came across a little paragraph that said this kid had asked me for help and I had told my teacher.
You describe a little bit in the book, maybe we should hear it, where we'll get the background, but here you are, you're in Beijing when almost no foreigners are there, certainly not from North America.
That's right.
You're out for a walk with another foreigner who's a student there, Erica, and a young woman approaches you. You don't really know her. She's not in your classes, but she's got a lot of curiosity and questions. Let's hear it, if you would, Jan, a little bit of reading from just that moment.
Okay. And Erica is the only other foreigner, the only other Westerner at Beijing University. She's an American of Chinese descent, and she and I have been there studying Chinese. Okay. Erica and I had been there nearly a year without one spontaneous encounter, so we were delighted when someone new approached us. The young woman had no inkling Erica and I were both starry-eyed Maoists. As we walked around the campus lake, she peppered us with questions. How much money did a worker make in America? Did every American have a refrigerator? What kind of class background was required to attend university? When we told her how much workers earned, she gasped. We grudgingly acknowledged that everyone had a fridge, and we conceded that there were no class-based restrictions on university attendance. Suddenly she said, "I want to go to America. Can you help me?"
I want to go to America. Can you help me? And that single question put her at risk, at no small part, not and more than risk, into a reality of what could easily have been a life sentence, kind of hard labor in the Chinese countryside. We'll come to the issue of why you decided to report her for that. But take us back up a little bit here. Starry-eyed Maoist in 1972 in Beijing. What produced that in you?
I was a typical bourgeois kid from Montreal. I didn't speak Chinese. I grew up taking ballet lessons and flute lessons. And, you know, I was head prefect in my high school, Montreal West High. And then I hit university in the late 60s when the whole of the Western world was in ferment, at least in universities. And we were protesting everything. It was the Vietnam War. And even in Canada, we were very aware of it. And we were receiving lots of U.S. draft dodgers. And so I decided to major in Chinese history. It was the Cold War. So my professors in Chinese history were actually extremely politicized, and they took the side of China. They were very pro-China, and they told me it was a utopia. It was fantastic. Mm. The Cultural Revolution was amazing. And so I was 19, and I was on my summer vacation from McGill University, and I decided to go check it out for myself. And once I got there, I had to go alone. They didn't give my friend a visa because she mm-hmm. wasn't ethnic Chinese. And once I got there, I realized my Mandarin 101 from McGill was completely useless. And so I begged them to let me study Chinese. Mm. And somehow I found myself in Beijing University being allowed to study there, the first Canadian.
And so there you were in the midst of the Cultural Revolution. You had a very starry-eyed view of it. We know now it was much tougher than your professors were perhaps presenting it in Canada at the end of the 1960s. Give us the context then. When this young woman, Chinese woman Yin Luyi, stepped up and asked you the question, can you help me get to America? What was the world out of which she was asking, Jan?
It was a world in which, well, Erica and I were surrounded by handpicked Chinese. We didn't realize quite how restricted our social circle was.
Beijing University, Beida, is like the top school in the country.
It's the Harvard of China. Mm-hmm. And most of the universities were still shut down in China during the Cultural Revolution, mm-hmm. but the government had reopened Beijing University. And our teachers were handpicked. Our roommates were handpicked. I had a Chinese roommate. So did Erica. And they moved in a special class of female students to be with us. And that's why when Yin Luyi approached us, we were really happy because people did not approach us in those days. And then when she asked us the question, we were quite shocked because my roommate never asked me anything about the West. And I didn't realize why. I just thought nobody was interested. Nobody wanted to go. I didn't understand the context of how much people censored themselves. And so when she asked us, we took it very simplistically. And I had had brushes with the authorities, and they had criticized me for reading too many English books because they said my duty was to study Chinese. Mm. And I was dying to read English, and so I found this secret cache of books at Beijing University Library, and I kept reading English, and they kept criticizing me. I thought it would be something along those lines. And also, Erica and I wanted to save her from the West. We were so anti-Western at that point. We were against shopping malls. We were feminists. We thought the West was bad for women because we wore pantyhose and lipstick and wedding rings. We were just a bunch of teenagers who thought we knew how the world should be.
But her question was, I want to go to America. Can you help me? What was the crime in that, in those days?
It's a thought crime. That's a thought crime. And in those days, people were getting punished for all kinds of thought crimes. Now, you're asking me in the context, if I knew everything that was going on in China, why was that wrong? At the time, I didn't think it was that wrong. I thought it was an ideological deviation. But in the actual reality of China of those years, it was a serious crime because you were not allowed to think that the motherland was anything less than paradise. And to want to leave was almost a traitorous act, and it would be punished as a traitorous act.
You knew it was wrong enough that you felt you should tell somebody. You should report it. Who'd you tell? Why?
I told my teacher. I think Erica told her teacher, too. We both mentioned it. And my teacher didn't react. My teacher just went on with the lesson. And that's why I didn't think it was such a big deal. Obviously, my teacher went on to report it. My teacher was a Communist Party member. And she must have gone on to report it. I never knew what happened to this woman because nothing did happen to her for the period of time that I remained at the university. I left a short while later in the summer of 1973, and nothing happened to this young woman for about 6 more months.
But it happened, and it happened big time, what they called forcible deportation back to the countryside, which was like a kind of life sentence to hard labor in those days.
Oh, it was, yes.
Once that came down, she knew what it meant. She tried to commit suicide the night before they took her off the campus.
She was arrested in the middle of the night by her classmates because you didn't need the police to arrest you in those days. Everything was the people power. Mm. So her classmate arrested her, and then she was dragged before the whole history department. She was a history student and denounced. My roommate was one of the people who was forced to denounce her. it turns out that my roommate was key to introducing us. I didn't remember that, but my roommate and this and Yin Louis had been on the volleyball team together, and that's how Yin Louis approached me, because otherwise she would have had no entree to talking to me and Erica. So she was denounced, and then she was told she was going to be sent off for hard labor to this very place where she had entered Beijing University, the same village. Now, Mao had sent down all the young people to the countryside to do labor during the Cultural Revolution. She had been an exemplary young...
The peasants, in effect, had sent her up, but now she was coming back to them and coming back to them in disgrace. You ultimately learned she could not even discuss with them, which, well, her life was hard. That gnawed on you. You went back many years later to find her. We're going to hear that part of the story behind us, a kind of Maoist anthem of that time, "The East is Red." Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about a story of betrayal, reunion, a stab at redemption in Beijing. Canadian Jan Wong went to China at the end of the Cultural Revolution, betrayed a classmate, went back decades later to learn what happened to her. You went back, and we'll talk about that. You searched for her. That's a story in itself. I know you a bit from our time working across, on neighboring desks 25 years ago. And still, Jan, for all that, it was hard for me to really plumb why a person would have done this. I wish you'd spend a little more time on that. I mean, you knew that the Cultural Revolution was not a complete mystery. Lots of people had been had suffered, and that was not completely unknown. You were in a kind of hermetic bubble at an elite university, but still, something made you so self-righteous you were willing to do that, even if it might mean something terrible for her.
No, I think. What we were studying, we were always studying Chairman Mao's works. And Chairman Mao made a clear distinction he has an essay called On Contradiction. Mm. And in it, he talks about contradiction among the people and contradiction with the enemy. And he makes it quite clear that if it's a contradiction among the people, then you save the person. You work with them. You help them. And to me, this kid was not the enemy. She was not an American spy. She was not one of the landlords, dripping blood. She was another kid, and obviously a bright kid to get into Beijing University. So I believed, I took at face value our Maoist studies, which said that because this is a contradiction among the people, she would be saved. And I think the other reason I wanted to do the right thing, because Erica and I talked about whether it was, we didn't want to snitch. We didn't like that. But we thought that was just our soft bourgeois sides, or this guilt stuff. And we wanted to do what the Chinese would do. And we believed this is what Chinese would do. And we didn't think there would be a life sentence for this kid at the end of it. But why did we want to do what the Chinese did? And I think it's because growing up in Canada, I had always felt like an outsider. Mm. And when I got to China, I finally felt I belonged. And so, because I looked the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very superficial, but
definitely.
I felt that, I felt I looked the same. I tried my best to walk like a Chinese, talk like a Chinese. Unfortunately, I'm left-handed, and I only say that's unfortunate because in China, nobody is. And every time I ate or wrote, people would gasp and realize I wasn't.
I mean, they may be, but they're not allowed to be left-handed.
Yes, that's right. They're changed. So I took off my watch because it was a women's watch, and they didn't have women's watches in those days. Mm. I got Chinese glasses made, which are rather ugly and would slide down my nose, but I really, really wanted to belong. And I think as adolescents or as teenagers, that's something that the power of that is something that's hard to remember when you're way past teen years.
You wanted to belong. She got shipped off to Manchuria and hard labor. They let her meet her parents on the way just for a moment. She was pale and sick, and her parents are weeping and moaning. They won't give her a single private moment with them. She's sent back to the countryside to a lousy diet, to complete ostracism within that village that she had come up out of after having been there earlier. I mean, she had years and years of really, really rough life.
She was not allowed to tell anybody what her crime was because, of course, that might give other people the same idea.
America.
In fact, Mao died, and she was sent off in 1975 in January. She was punished. I was already back at university in Montreal, and I didn't know. But Mao died in September of 1976. So that's when, if he hadn't died, and if things hadn't changed, she would have been there for life. But he died. Her father, who was also in political trouble himself, who was a powerful man, but in political trouble, he could not save her, but he managed to get her out of the countryside and into a job in the oil fields of Manchuria.
And no garden spot either, though.
No. Three shifts a day. But she's a survivor. Louis was very bright, very pretty, very smart. And she, when they put out a note saying, anybody want to work on the propaganda team of the oil fields, she raised her hand because she could read and write in Chinese, and her calligraphy was very beautiful. Mm-hmm. So she got out of the three shifts. And
put
she
on the
got
propaganda
into an
team in a day shift.
Yeah.
The story,
and then she fought her way back. She got back to Beijing. That's what is so remarkable.
Not just that she got there. And save the end a little bit here, Jen, because it's really kind of astonishing what you ultimately find here, but let's not leap ahead.
Okay.
You say you found a little note in a diary. You wrote an earlier book, Red China Blues, where you mentioned this story about what you had in effect done to Louis.
Yeah.
You found a note in your diary. When did you begin to take that seriously again? And how did it gnaw so deeply at you that a few summers back here, not long ago, you packed up your whole family and went back to China to spend a summer just looking for Louis?
Well, I put it in Red China Blues, and I thought about whether I should put it in. I knew that people would be very critical of me, and they have been, but I felt it was important to tell the truth, but also to explain the context and also why Chinese people turned in their parents and their classmates. And
which they did, in large numbers.
I wanted to explain that it's not a racial thing. They're not any less human than we are in the West, but I wanted to explain the Cultural Revolution. Everybody gets caught up in it. When you were playing The East Is Red, that music, I have to say, I felt transported back to that time of idealism, of unity, that the whole of China was working towards a bright future, and Chairman Mao was really the red sun in people's hearts. I mean, that music is just very moving when I hear it.
You remind us of another popular ditty from that time where the lyrics are, this is Cultural Revolution time in China, Daddy is dear, Mommy is dear, but neither is as dear as Chairman Mao.
That's right.
They are expendable.
That one sort of fell by the wayside, though, because that was too extreme, and people sort of made fun of it. But yes, people were singing it for a while. People were dancing the loyalty dance in China. That all stopped before I got there. I didn't see people doing this stupid loyalty dance.
When did you decide to do what to try and make this good?
Well, it had bothered me all these years, and because I wrote about it in Red China Blues, people never let me forget it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if I could just pretend it didn't happen. I had a chance to write a book about Beijing on the eve of the Olympics, and my publisher wanted me to describe the city and the changes. So I decided this was it. This was my only chance to go back. I had 1 month, and I wanted my family to go because I didn't have the guts or the courage or the moral fortitude to look for her on my own. I thought it would be very depressing to have to hunt for her, and I didn't think I could find her. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my family before I even left. I told them once we got there. They didn't want to go with me.
Your husband knew what he was getting into a bit. You had met him in China. He'd been a draft dodger in China in the 70s. You met and married there. Your sons, teenage boys, didn't have so much of an idea what they were getting into with their mom here.
Right. My husband is a New York Jewish white draft dodger who went to China in 66. So he understood, and he has never blamed me for what I did because he knew the context. And to him, it was perfectly logical that someone would go there and be swept up in the Cultural Revolution. You know, one of the things is last week was the 50th anniversary of the Tibetan, of the Dalai Lama's flight out of Tibet.
Yes, uprising and, crushed there in the Dalai Lama across the border, out, yep.
Yeah, and what I want to say is what people don't realize is during the Cultural Revolution in Tibet, it was Tibetan Red Guards who destroyed the monasteries and the libraries. This is not usually mentioned. We mentioned that they were destroyed during the Cultural Revolution, but it was the local Red Guards. Chinese Red Guards from the rest of China didn't stream into Tibet. The young people in Tibet got caught up.
Your point there is?
My point is that young people, it doesn't matter who they are, young people will do things that they will later regret. They will be manipulated and swept up. And they will regret it later because when I went to Tibet reporting on an earlier trip, I met a man my age who was crying when he told me what he had done. And he was now sending his son to be a lama in the monastery. But he told me he burned the library and he was so sad because it was his own heritage.
Are you saying they burned their own library so it's okay that I betrayed Louis?
No, mm-hmm. I'm explaining mm-hmm. how a person can do this, how a young person can mm-hmm. do something like this, and how, because it's not just one person, it's basically the whole country did it.
What did you want to happen in that month, just last summer in Beijing, in that very dramatic run-up to the Beijing Olympics?
I wanted to find her, to say I was sorry, to tell her that I really am sorry for what I did, and if there was any way I could make amends, I would want to make amends. I really wanted to apologize.
We'll talk about the story of how that unfolded. Let's take some calls here first. Jan Wong joins us from Toronto. Her book is A Comrade Lost and Found, A Beijing Story, and you've got the outlines of it now. Betty, in Sarasota, Florida, you're on the air with Jan Wong.
Hi, Jan Wong. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Hi. How are you?
Good. Nice to be on the show. First time ever, Tom. It's always a great show. I listen to you almost daily.
Great to have you.
This is an amazing topic. Jan, I was 19 when I left Montreal, so I'm also a former Montrealer. And I traveled halfway around the world. I went to the Middle East. And I guess, you know, I'm not here to blame you because I guess your public is going to do that to some degree. And I think it's fantastic and honorable that, you know, you're getting out there and you've written this book and you've spent so much time, if not years, pursuing this young woman. But I'm trying to get into your mind when you were that age. So again, this is not blaming. I'm just very mm-hmm. analytic and interested and fascinated. And I want to find out how it was possible as a young college-age young adult from a free world, when you went to China, did you not sense a huge, stark difference, seeing that so many people were censored and how quiet they must have been, and that the whole environment was so completely polar from what you know?
Betty, let me hold the question right there if we may. It's a very important one, and I'm glad for it. I want to get a couple more here, and then we'll let Jan dig in because we've got several on this theme. Let me get one more from Chesapeake, Virginia. Alexis, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I actually do understand how a 19-year-old, even from the West, can really be swept up in the whole Cultural Revolution. That is not an issue for me. My issue is that it took the author so long to even remember the situation happening. I don't know, you know, I know we forget a lot of things, but I even remember some of the sundriest of events in my life, and it wasn't until you opened the diary, I think, that you said you saw the paragraph and realized what had taken place because you have worked, you have, you know.
Right. How could you forget the question right there? And Alexis, mm-hmm. thanks for that. Let us hold that one. And let me get one more. We've got Betty and Alexis. Let me get one more. Chen Chi calling from Boston. Chen Chi, you're on the air with Jan Wong.
Yes. Hi, Jan. I guess my question was similar to the previous caller. I thought that, you know, I understand that you were idealistic and that you were impressionable, but I just don't understand how, you know, like you grew up in a Western world and you have your own critical thinking. So how come when you went to study in China and you didn't put forward your own judgment and then you were, I don't know, kind of like brainwashed by the by the regime at the time. And I mean, maybe it's what happened. I mean, because the Nazi probably, you know, they did the same thing to their youth and not, I don't know.
Chen-Chi, we've got it. Jan, there you go. I mean, between Betty and Alexis and Chen-Chi, essentially, how could you have done this and how could you forget?
Okay. I think Betty talked about China being so different and how could I not see it? I saw it. I thought it was fantastic. I crossed that border in Shenzhen, which is now a city of millions, but
no,
it was a
Hong
little
Kong.
Tiny...
Mm-hmm.
Right, by Hong Kong. And I remember seeing people walking around. Women were wearing the same clothing as men. I thought it was wonderful. There was no crime. People rode around on bicycles. There was no pollution. I was completely caught up in this different world, and I thought it was wonderful. And that's why I went to China in the first place. I was already predisposed by my professors at McGill University to think this was a utopia, where actually they were working out the problems of humanity, of selfishness, of waste.
But Chen-Chi says you were raised in the West. You were taught to think in a Western way. It should have been more analytical. You should have been probing.
Well, I thought I was analytical and probing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went back after I wrote Red China Blues, and after Tiananmen Square, and I went to find my professor at McGill who had taught me all this. He was retired. And I said, what were you thinking that you told me? You gave me such a simplistic view of China. And he said, it was the Cold War, and China was under attack. And, you see, he had worked in China, so he knew better. He spoke fluent Chinese. He said it was a Cold War. We had to take sides. We were either pro-China or anti-China. And so he said, you know, that's why we told you all this. I think people don't remember what it was like. I wish people would just roll back their minds to when Nixon made that historic trip to China.
100 days before you arrived.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the press went gaga. The American press talked about the clean streets, the healthy living, the fact that you couldn't, you know, there was no theft, no crime. These were a different kind of people.
And
there
to Alexa's question, we have a break coming up, but you really and truly forgot. It just was out of your mind.
How come I forgot? I forgot because it wasn't there. I didn't expect there to be significant repercussions, and that's why I forgot.
Boy, were you wrong.
That showed how little I knew, how stupid I was. But that's why I forgot. It didn't mean a big deal. It was as if I found something on the subway and turned it in 10 years ago. I wouldn't remember. But maybe that would have had huge repercussions on someone's life. But because you don't know at the time, and if I had known, I hope I wouldn't have done it. If I had known what would happen to her, I don't think I would have done it. I would have just walk away. Mm. Just walk away. It's too much.
That's summer.
Too big a burden. Mm. But I didn't know, and so it wasn't a big deal. And if I hadn't written it in my diary, I really believe that I wouldn't even remember. Because when I went back to my teacher at Beijing University, when I was hunting for her, and I said, do you remember? And she said, no, she didn't remember. But she's the one who reported her. And
last
she
summer,
Jen Long
went back to find her and did. We'll hear about that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about a story of betrayal, reunion, a stab at redemption in Beijing. Canadian Jan Wong went to China at the end of the Cultural Revolution, betrayed a fellow student, went back to learn what happened to her. She's written about that time and the time back looking and finding. The book is A Comrade, Lost and Found, a Beijing story. Jan Wong joins us from Toronto, where she worked for many years for the Toronto Globe and Mail. Let's get a call from Bloomingdale, New York. George, you're on the air.
In the Red Book, Mao says that young people have no sense of history and they are easily persuaded. Now, that's true of young people everywhere, but he capitalized on that. And that's why what you're speaking about today is so fascinating, because he had his finger right on the button.
The Little Red Book had it right there. Jan, there you were in China. Your Chinese name translated bright, precious. Were you bright, precious, and skillfully played?
Well, actually, Mao George is right. Mao, the whole Cultural Revolution was launched because Mao was being sidelined. And he did an end run around the Politburo and the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, and he went straight to the young people. And he told them, China is in danger of going backwards. We need your help. We need you to make revolution. And the young people just, I mean, and I include those in Tibet, the young people all over heeded his call and started bullying their principals and their teachers and their parents, and they took over the country. And yeah, he understood completely how intoxicating it is for young people to suddenly break all the rules.
Rob in Salem, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Jan Wong.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for moderating a great discussion.
What do you think, Rob?
The reason I'm calling is because Jen's story really resonates with me as an Iranian-American. I was born after the Iranian Revolution,
mm-hmm.
but I've learned a great deal about sort of the history of the turbulent 78-79 period. And a great number of students were sent over by the Shah, actually, to the U.S. and to Europe to get professional educations and pursue, I guess, post-secondary education. And a lot of these young people, partly as a result of feeling alienated in their new countries that they had been studying in, were, you know, swept up in the new left, in all sorts of Marxisms and Maoisms and so forth. And they went back and actually played a pretty big role in overthrowing the Shah's regime. And I feel like the irony of that being that, you know, ultimately conditions for young people, intellectuals and so forth, were infinitely better under the Shah than they are now under the Islamic Republic.
So does that leave you feeling sympathetic toward Jan or critical of Jan? What, Rob?
I actually felt a little bit sympathetic. I mean, I was born after all this happened, but I think that, you know, as an immigrant myself, I kind of understand that feeling of alienation, how, you know, movements, sort of all-encompassing systematic movements like Marxism can be so attractive because they have an answer for any, you know, any aspect of life. Marxism has, you know, answers for from media to, you know, how to understand, you know, obviously the economy to politics to everything. And it's just this perfect system. So I could see how it had that attraction.
Perfect, quote unquote.
Yeah.
There's an Iranian-American perspective. Rob, thanks for calling. Jan, let me get one more here on this theme. Carol in Worcester, Massachusetts. Carol, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. It's nice to speak with you today. And I really, really appreciate everything that Jen Wong is saying. And I identify with a lot of it, not with respect so much to China, but in the same era, the GDR, East Germany, because I grew up in a family where my father really was caught up in that ideology. I mean, he was an immigrant, but very much in sync with the idea that people could be equal and everybody has a job and things are running smoothly, and that it's really in the West that there are more problems, even though there are more so-called freedoms, that they don't always lead to an egalitarian culture and society.
But of course, that described utopia also, totalitarian, the Stasi fully at work, and with a whole downside of its own that Jan Wong's victim, for example, felt in China.
Right. Well, but still, I remember a previous caller suggesting that perhaps Jan at that time was not, you know, analytical and probing in order to kind of see through whatever were the ills and faults of the Chinese regime and society. But, you know, I remember very distinctly at that time myself thinking that it was my Western peers here, you know, even when I was in high school, who were not analytical and probing about the ills mm-hmm. and failures of Western culture.
Carol, we've got it. Jan, there's perspectives from East Germany and from the Islamic Republic. How do you respond?
Well, I find that the people from the Eastern Bloc countries really understand my book because they went through it too. And to say that I was not analytical and probing, I think is missing the point. In fact, I was analyzing and studying all the time when I was in China. I told I write that I studied Das Kapital. We had study groups. We took it very seriously. We studied Mao. I really wanted to understand the Chinese Revolution. And I think I was more analytical than the average Western kid. For one thing, I was curious. I wanted to go to China and see this new country for myself. So I don't think it's right to portray me as quite the idiot that I wasn't. I really was fascinated, and I wanted to learn the language, and I wanted to immerse myself. And any chance I got, I took part in Chinese life, so that when my classmates had to do hard labor, I wanted to, not just because I wanted to fit in, but because I wanted to get the point. I didn't get why everybody had to do hard labor, and I wanted to experience it all for myself. So I think this Carol from Worcester understands, I think, because of her own family history in East Germany. And the Iranian American caller, he understands too, even though he's much younger, because he's closer to that group of people who became radicalized from their stay in the U.S. and went back. I mean, I think I was radicalized by my upbringing in Canada. At the time, it was a time of real change and real questioning. Young people today are very interested in the environment. And in those days, we were really interested in world politics.
I'm sure all of our listeners will be weighing the sort of ratios of knowing and naivete here, but the clock ticks relentlessly. You went back, I guess it was 2006 first, to look for Liu Yi. How on earth does one do that in a country of, what is it, a billion three now?
Yeah, a billion three.
How did you... Even
really
begin.
Hard, really hard, because people have, there's about 100 surnames in China. I didn't know Louis's exact name, meaning I didn't know which Chinese characters were her name. I went back to see my roommate. She was my closest link. She wasn't even sure what the names were. I went back to Beijing University. People have moved. People use cell phones. There's no directory. I didn't even know if this person was alive or not. Or
and
whether
it turns
she
out she had changed her name over these years to try and kind of escape the curse that's right. You in part had left her with.
Her surname was so unusual that to protect her father from her own political shame, she changed her name. So that, I was already hunting and for a person whose name had changed. And Beijing University, when I went there to ask about records, because I didn't know where she was from. I didn't know anything about her. They said there were no records from the Cultural Revolution. That was just a black hole.
Swept away.
So very hard. I went back to find my teacher. My teacher didn't even remember that I had turned her in and that she had then further turned her in. It was really hard.
Cell phones helped in the end. China is covered with cell phones.
Yeah.
And you sort of swang from call to call. Fortune came in here.
And I had to be careful. I couldn't tell people. Some people, I couldn't tell them why I was looking for her, because then they would not have helped me. I just had to say, I had a relationship with this person and I'm really thinking about her. And, do you know her? I couldn't tell everybody why.
Beijing was being radically remade during this time for the Beijing Olympics. I mean, torn down, built up, transformed, so you couldn't even recognize it. And most people didn't even want to think back. They didn't want, to remember.
They said, why are you looking for her? Nobody does that. I mean, what's the point? And it's true. They don't want to. There's this sort of amnesia about the Cultural Revolution. They don't want to go there. It's very painful. Many people were both victims and victimizers, and they don't want to go there. And they couldn't understand why I did. And I tried to explain that I wanted to apologize, and they just said, nobody does that. Why are you doing this?
But you kept searching. The cell phones were ringing all over the place. There's a little reading here I wish you'd do for us. We have to bear in mind that your Chinese name translates bright, precious. Your husband's wonderfully translates fat paycheck.
He doesn't like that, but it's accurate.
Read for us, Jen.
Okay. Suddenly my cell phone rings. Fat paycheck has it. He answers it and hands it to me. Who is it? I ask. It's the person you've been looking for. I stare at him, speechless. He repeats himself. It's the person you've been looking for. I grab the phone and shout over the din, Wei, Wei, which means hello, hello. Bright precious, this is Yin Lui, says a low, utterly feminine voice on the other end. My heart stops. I'm afraid she'll hang up on me if I say anything. I've never forgotten you, she continues. She doesn't sound sarcastic. She sounds pleased. She keeps talking. I've always thought about you. I can see your big, shiny eyes. I'm so sorry, I blurt. I'm so sorry for what I did. To my astonishment, she says, no, no, you didn't affect me at all. All that had nothing to do with you.
All that had nothing to do with you? She wasn't even ready to, I guess, hear that apology. What did she mean by that? It had nothing to do with you.
Well, it took me a while to understand. I kept trying to apologize. She kept saying it's okay. And then finally she said to me, you know, you didn't have enough power or influence to ruin my life. 25 or 30 other people turned me in. And I stopped cold because in all these years, I had never considered that possibility. I thought I was the only one that her entire life and her fate hung in the balance because of what I had done. It doesn't excuse what I did, but it opens up the perspective that it wasn't just me. There was a whole bunch of people out there very willing to turn her in.
And then you got the story, eventually, sort of gently from her, of her suicide attempt when everything hit the fan, of her exile in the countryside, her exile in the oil fields, her marriage to a Red Guard out of Beijing that took her back. She studied the law because she thought law might come back on the other side of Mao, and indeed it did, brought her back to Beijing. And by the time you met her, well, kind of an astonishing transformation. Give us just a sense of the woman Lu Yi and her circumstances, what she had become.
Well, she was a beautiful woman in her 50s, and her dream had come true. She had gone to the U.S. She had overstayed her visa because that's the kind of person she is. She doesn't follow the rules. And she had lived in the U.S. Happily for several years until 9/11, and then she decided to return to China. And she had just remarried a professor at Beijing University, a widower, and lived on the campus in an American-built house. I couldn't get over that. And she owned
one of the nicest
property.
Houses on the campus. And we can't miss this. She and her husband owned five homes between them.
That's right. And she had her own car. He had his own car. She just was rich. She was rich. She was happy. She had a fake Gucci bag. She had pink lip gloss and her hair was permed. And she was just herself. This was the person she had always wanted to be. And the funny thing was, I thought, you know, she tried so hard to get to America, but really America had come to China.
It took a lot of grit. She'd sort of clawed her way up almost Scarlett O'Hara style here. And there
exactly.
She was, living quite the life, finally. And the funny thing was, she didn't really want to hear your apology even. I mean, you write that you felt a little let down, like, I came all this way, you know,
yeah.
I searched for you. I came here to beat my breast and apologize. Come on, hear me out.
But then I realized it's enough. Every time I apologized, she said it's okay, and I was making her exonerate me over and over again. So I just shut up. I just said, enough. And what I did was I just listened to her. I didn't interrogate her. I didn't interview her. You know, that's what I do for a living. And I stopped. I thought, she'll just tell me what she wants to tell me, and I'll listen. And if there are spaces or blank spots, I'm just going to leave it. I'm not going to push her. She can just tell me her story, and I'll listen. So, yes, I descended on her out of the blue. She wasn't prepared at all. And we saw each other as much as we could. There were 11 days left before I had to leave, and we saw each other as much as I could. And, you know, in the end, when I told her, you don't understand, I wasn't forced to report you. I told them on my own. I voluntarily turned you in. That's when she was hurt, but she didn't tell me right away. She phoned me on the last day when I was on my way to the airport, and she said that really hurt her. And I said, I'm sorry again.
You're telling
me. But you know, I went back to see her.
Last summer.
I went
summer.
Back.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, after the book was out.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
she
mm-hmm.
had adjusted. She had adjusted to everything. I wanted to give her the book.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, she had time to digest what had happened, and she said she really appreciates so much that I tried to find her and that I found her and that I apologized. So it took, you know, she couldn't adjust right away. I just descended on her like a ton of bricks.
You're telling the story, so we're getting your version, I guess. But
yeah.
we hear what unfolded. Were you redeemed? Did you feel redeemed?
Somewhat redeemed. I think that you can never make up for what you did. You can only, then try to make amends or correct it somehow. No, you can't. You can't undo the past. But I think I wanted to teach my kids, everyone makes mistakes. I do believe everyone makes mistakes. And I think it's how you deal with it afterwards that is so important.
And in a word, Jan, China, does it want to remember? Do people talk about this over beers, or is the great unspoken time the Cultural Revolution?
They don't want to remember, and they don't speak about it.
Jan Wong's new book is A Comrade Lost and Found, a Beijing story. We were colleagues many years ago. It's our first sort of mini reunion here. Jan, I appreciate your sharing your time with us and sharing the story. Let's talk about China again. Thanks for being here today.
It's so great talking to you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.